Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. This episode is for March 11th, 2014. My guest is Wayne Herring. Wayne is a small-scale family farmer and business owner located in central Pennsylvania who is doing pasture-raised poultry and pork. He is also a past guest on the show, so if this is your first time hearing him, I recommend you go back and listen to the other two. The first is from about a year ago when we sat down and talked about his work to transition to being a small-scale farmer. His second appearance on the show was as part of a listener question and answer session to discuss more about what it's like to actually do this work. This third conversation is more about his life as a farmer now that he and his family are all working out of their home. He's moved away from his corporate job and is now running a small, home-based business in addition to his work as a farmer, with he and his wife homeschooling their four children. But you'll hear plenty of that in the interview. As we discuss those pieces of his life, as well as the many hats that he wears as a farmer, as a business person, all the different things that go into that kind of a life. We travel here and there throughout the conversation because, as he shares with us at the end, there is less structure in his life and therefore less in this conversation. I also spent a lot of time laughing in this discussion, much of which you won't hear as I edited it out. But Wayne does point out some of those moments where I was, and that stemmed from really a place of joy and a feeling of commonality with much of what he was going through in his work, as well as what feels like some of the insanity sometimes that goes with being someone who's trying to make a difference and build a better world. If you enjoy this episode, please help me make more like it. Being able to record live and interact with guests is an experience that I find leads to even more openness and candor, and your contributions help make that happen. Go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. There you'll find how to make a recurring monthly donation. As little as $5 a month can make a huge difference in my ability to budget and plan for the future. Or you can also, from the second set of drop-down boxes, on that same page, make a one-time contribution. Now then, on to Wayne Herring. I'll join you afterwards with some of my thoughts. And through the magic of recording and the internet, though this is a couple of weeks after the Q&A session we released, I'm still sitting here with Wayne Herring in the beginning of January 2014. But we're sitting here talking about farming now that you've made more of a transition to the work that you're doing, that you can do more of this full-time. I wanted to continue and expand on that conversation that we had before, not necessarily about the transition, which we kind of covered, but what it's like now to be making these business decisions as a farmer and be networking and growing your business, connecting with customers, how you kind of do all that on this small scale without like the large support structure, perhaps, of someone who's in like a cooperative like Land O'Lakes, or, you know, someone who's just a farmer producing for Purdue, doing just like some kind of a commodity or a monocrop. You're really here. As I drove up, you have your chickens that are out there being pastured, that are your laying hens. You're raising chickens for meat. You raise pigs. We've talked about, you know, you would like to move to be raising beef, all the pieces that kind of go into that conversation. And if you're open to it, also to touch on that article that you had sent me, you had written about what it's like to be a small-scale farmer to try to pay your people a living wage, what that means, and how much that actually impacts the price of your food. I know that I posted some of that information to the Facebook page for the show a couple months ago, and it was rather eye-opening how much goes into the price of your food that has nothing to do with the labor involved. So kind of a big lead-up of the topics that we're going to cover today. Of course, if you haven't heard the first interview and you're listening to this for the first time, there is a link in the show notes so you can hear that first piece with Wayne and then pick this up as kind of a follow-up. So Wayne, where would you like to begin this conversation?
Would I like to start to follow up? But you were supposed to ask the questions. So pick up from where we were last time. As I recall, last time it was early in the growing season, our growing season, and I was sitting in the same room talking to you on the telephone. And so I guess a fair bit has happened since then. It is now, yes, January, and the only animals that we have on the farm right now are the laying hens and the kids' pet rabbits and the children's pet cats that we have out in the garage there. And so it's sort of a calm time in terms of the farm production. The only thing that I'm doing now is we do still have some meat that we're selling from our freezers to our customers, those who don't have a deep freeze and weren't able to buy, let's say, a quarter pig or a half pig. And I have a pile of thank you cards here in my drawer. So I'm going to be doing, actually later today after you leave, I'll probably be doing some looking at who purchased last year, my customers, and who did a lot of purchasing so that we can send them a special thank you. And the other thing that's happening is it's the time of year where we're going to go to the Pennsylvania Association of Sustainable Agriculture Conference to learn a little bit more and meet some other people and network. And it's also a time of year where I've been already ordering piglets from my favorite producer of feeder pigs. So that's kind of what's going on now, as well as I'm working here full time, no longer employed in corporate America, but now working for myself.
It's amazing how much can happen when we move at the speed of life and all we make these changes to try to embody what it is we care about and live the life that we want to. And it's, well, I've been fortunate enough to eat some of the chicken that's come off of the farm here. And I have to say that I enjoyed it immensely compared to what I got from the supermarket, having recipes and knowing what I can do with these organs that I don't normally get when I get this anonymous prepackaged styrofoam sanitized meat, that there's an animal here that I get to see that then becomes my food, and it reconnects me not only to my food chain, but also to the people who produce it and what it's like to be a customer of someone who's doing this kind of work. You say you have your stack of thank you cards that you're going to be sending out and tracking through your previous sales. Is there a lot of that one-on-one contact with customers in order to network and sustain and grow your small family farming operation?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Having people out here at the farm and having them see what we do, getting to talk with them, and really ask them questions like, why are you here? Saying to a customer, you know, why have you chosen to look for us on this country road off the beaten path? What are you looking for? And of course, there's a variety of answers that they give us, whether it's connection with their food, their health, concerns about animal welfare, looking for chemical-free food. There's all kinds of reasons. And yes, it's that one-on-one connection is very important. And of course, that's what brings us more customers, because they tell other people about the food that they've eaten, that they bought when they came out here to the farm. And they often tell people the story of, you know, they drove up the lane, they saw the animals, they saw our children. All those things are, yeah, those are critically important. And of course, in today's world, you just said that you enjoyed some of the chicken that you bought, and it was good to have you and your family out here. Of course, we didn't get to talk to you very much because we were busy serving customers. And I recall, you know, you guys going and sitting on the tractor, and it all, things happen very fast when we're having customer pickup. But you got to eat the chicken, and so you just said that you liked it, which is good. And we serve a lot of desires and needs, but one of the reasons people come to buy our food is because it just tastes really good. And yesterday I had a Facebook post that was, it wasn't posted to our farm page, it was posted to my personal page. I had a guy who's a business client of my new home-based business that's going to help pay the bills and enable us to raise a family here on our 20 acres and really do the farming work that we're doing. But this business client, I gave him a pack of pork chops as a sort of a Christmas present. And it was meant to say thank you for doing business with my business coaching practice that I'm starting. But it was also intended to give some good food to somebody who I know is an influencer in the community. And so yesterday it happened. He prepared the pork chops And I know he didn't think they're going to be very special. A lot of people humor me when I give them my food, and I try not to oversell it or overbill it. But yesterday, the Facebook post came in, and it said in all capital letters, "No joke, these were the best pork chops I've ever had." And you can sense, even in the Facebook post, the surprise that it's anything different than the commodity pork that they buy in the grocery store. People are shocked that it really tastes better, but it does. Food is really not a commodity. It's not all the same, just in the same way, you know, that cars aren't the same, etc.
By virtue of my wife being your cousin, we're now related by marriage and all these other things. So we're family. And I say that because the way that I really got connected to your food was at one of the family reunions. You brought a crock pot full of, I believe it was chicken hearts. And I'm sitting there, it was me and you and your brother talking about food and some of the work that I was doing. You're like, "Here, try one of these." I'm like, "Oh, not my favorite thing. Organs are not it." And you're like, no, try this. I'm like, "Okay, now I see why." And then we just stood there, we're standing over this open crock pot full of chicken hearts, just eating and talking and discussing farming and all these other things. It's interesting the difference that it makes having those foods that come from those situations. In that case, knowing the farmer who raises the food, who knows how to cook it, that I'm not sitting there going, "Well, I have no idea how this is going to taste." But also from that, one of the recent interviews that I released before we're sitting here having this conversation was with Arthur Haynes about wild foods. And we started talking about, well, what happens when you start looking at breeds and animals and other things that are raised closer to their natural habitat, their natural diet, how that changes, like the omega-6 versus omega-3 fatty acid ratios and whatnot. And I can just think about, there's another farmer who we buy pork from, who pastures his pork and lets them run through some acorns. And the difference in the fat and the way that that pork puts on fat and the way that it tastes and what you get. And it's just, it's so good. And I love food and the way that it can connect people and the difference that it makes when it's not, I mean, at least to my palate, when it comes from that environment, it tastes better. But also all the different connections that you get with the people who are making the food and being here and knowing that when I buy food from you, that it makes an impact directly on your family. And though I might not have the same health needs or environmental needs that some other clients may have or other people may have, but that those are options that are available to the consumer by being able to make a choice and connecting with a farm or farmer who is doing this kind of work and believes very much in the quality of their product and their long-term goals that are more than just food or financial profits. But leading to that last side about the financial side, and having touched on like growing your business, if you're okay, I would like to talk about that piece that you sent me about farming profits and making a living wage and paying a living wage. I don't know how specific you want to be about that, but if you can just walk us through what your goals are as a farmer, both for your own income, for income for your employees, and how that really breaks down into the business of running a farm.
Sure. Well, the employees right now are us, the family, primarily. And I've got four children, which in today's world sounds like a lot. But to my Old Order Mennonite friends, they think I'm sort of a wimp and that four isn't very many and I'm not quite keeping up. But four children is a lot. Not all of them are as interested in farming. Some of them do the things we ask them to do because, well, we're the parents and we tell them to do these things. But others are definitely very interested in the farm. And who knows? We don't have any. Catherine, my wife, and I do not have any specific goals right now in terms of, you know, 10 years from now, we want to be providing this much income and farming this many acres. That's really not on the radar screen right now. However, if the children are interested and want to do more of this work, I would like to be able to provide that opportunity to them, you know, not just give it to them, but if they're working hard at this, we want to be able to have a farm that will allow them to do that work. From a financial point of view, in the article that you're talking about, actually what had happened was for the first time this year, so it's been 4 years, and for the first time this year, I started to hear some murmurs via Facebook conversations, emails asking for feedback, conversations one-on-one with customers. For the first time, I heard some resistance, if you will, to the prices that we charge. Or I heard some statements like, we think you are expensive compared to your competition. And the reality is, I don't have anybody who does what we do right around here. There are certainly other small farms, sustainable farms within Southeast Pennsylvania that do what we do, but many of them are in the Lancaster area. There's a farmer in Bloomsburg that does farming like we do. They're around us, but there's nobody right here that's within the county that does what we do, at least to the scale that we're doing it now. And we are still small scale. So it's trying to figure out who's our competition. And what happened was, people explained to me that, quote, the competition was some brand names that are in the grocery store that are advertised as being natural. So, you know, if people are saying this, I don't believe that I should be defensive, if you will. There's a fine line there. I want to explain what we're doing and how what we're doing is different than some of the labels in the grocery store. But I don't think it does me any good to be overly critical. Rather, I just need to try to explain thoroughly what we do and why we do it. So I've done some posts in the past that had to do with pasture grazing, source of the feed that we give the animals, benefits of having the animals out in the sun, the things that, you know, try to hit on the things that are really important to people, the benefits, if you will, to them. But I also did a post that, I guess it was an email to my customer base, which we have about 500 people that are on our email list. And I sent out an email to them very openly explaining what some of the sources of cost are. How should I say? I don't think I need to justify my prices to anyone exactly. And yet I don't mind telling people what goes into the price. And so the little spreadsheet that I'd put together and the numbers and the way I ran things were based on the premise that I wanted to be paid $30 an hour for the labor that we put into the farm. And that would be my labor, or if we had an employee or a family member. If I add that up over the course of a year for most people, that's, you know, $30 an hour times, was it 2,080 hours in a year is the average working year. You know, it comes up to be a little bit more than $60,000 a year. But that's gross. That's not net. That's not bottom line income, because what would come from that normally that would be paid by somebody if they have a job is, you know, job with a typical job working for an employer. Oftentimes they get some form of health benefits, which, you know, we do not. We pay those things ourselves now. And also, you know, they get part of the Social Security tax paid, so on and so forth. So that's not net, that's gross. So when I put this spreadsheet together, I put a lot of the costs of things that went into producing a pound of pasture-raised chicken, and also that labor factor. So I think that's what you're referring to, is the email that had those numbers in it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about, because it was at $4 a pound. If I remember right, like the largest cost was actually feeding the chickens.
Oh, sure.
And it was like, by the time you break everything down, in order to meet that goal of $30 an hour was pennies on the dollar relative to the rest of the costs involved in that pound of chicken. Yeah, $60,000, I know, for many folks can sound like a lot of money. And in some cases, if that's your net income, it is. There's a lot that you can do with more than $1,000 a week as income. And I only learned this as I've begun expanding what I'm doing with this show, with teaching permaculture and everything else, by trying to be completely professional about it. All the costs that are involved. And I can't speak to yours, but for like mine, you mentioned the Social Security tax. I never realized that half of my Social Security was paid by my employer, which is like 7.5%. Now that I'm on my own, Social Security costs me 15% of my gross income. Then there are taxes, you know, state, local, federal. I'm sure by having people on your farm, you have to have general liability insurance. You have probably insurance for food safety. And these are all those pieces that as a business owner, by the time you pay all those things, it can be a large percentage of your income, or as many folks who I know who are just starting businesses, all of your income for a year while you're growing, while you're trying to get things off the ground. That idea of, you know, are you in the red or are you in the black? Are you going to make a profit or not in a year?
Right. And the other thing that goes into that, Scott, too, is that generally, farmers doing my kind of farming are also not going to work 12 months out of the year, be producing chicken income 12 months out of the year, because we normally work within seasonal constraints. And now, of course, there's other things we can do with that time. There's other ways to generate income, right? So it's not all just based on the farm. But I think a core and critical question in this is $60,000. And if we, you know, net that out, let's just say it's $50,000. Sounds like a lot of money. And in particular, it sounds like a lot of money for a farmer, right? I think society would say that's a lot of money for a farmer. And therein lies why wouldn't a farmer deserve or expect to be paid as much as whoever else makes $50,000. I think I actually, after the discussion on your Facebook page, I actually looked up some median income statistics because I was curious who makes $50,000 a year that's okay. And there's lots of positions and lots of jobs that pay like that. And certainly, I can tell you, I'm not making $50,000 a year as a farmer, right? You're here and you see the scale, and that's all accounting for just trying to design the price so that, in theory, if we did scale up, you'd be able to make $30 an hour. Because of inefficiencies, we're not even at that for the labor we put into it. But we love doing it, and there's other things at play, and there's other intellectual, emotional compensation that comes out of it. It was simply an example for customers and to help them understand and see. You know, personally, I think people that produce, you know, and this is, there's other people, of course, I'm sort of like a parrot here, repeating things that other people in the sustainable farming movement say. So these are probably not my own ideas. It's things, you know, that have seeped into my head that I believe in and that makes sense to me. And I think somebody producing your food is worth being paid as much as those other list of occupations that pay that on average.
I had a conversation with Seth Wilner probably a year and a half ago, and he is an extension educator, I think from New Hampshire. And we were talking about holistic management and whole farm planning. And part of that conversation was that I feel that in the United States, at least from my perspective, as it's portrayed in the news and elsewhere, because of the idea of, you know, migrant farm workers and picking produce and all this other stuff, that farming is not skilled labor. That from talking with Seth, with you and other people who are farming, that really is a myth. One of my past guests, Michael Polarski, he was a fruit picker for years and years and years. That's what he did for a living. But when he's out there picking fruit, he needs to know what farm is going to have fruit that is in season that he has the skill to pick, because he knows what's ripe or isn't. Because he's out there with a basket picking day after day after day as different things become ripe on the trees. Or to get something to know that it's from here to the market is a week. So I need to be picking the ones that are only this ripe, otherwise they're going to spoil before they get there. Or like you as a farmer, you know, you're doing your farm meeting to plan, you have a spreadsheet where you're running numbers so that you know what all your inputs and outputs are, to know who is the producer who produces a product that meets your standards, to know how long it's going to take to raise a pig from a piglet to the time that you want to butcher it, or whether or not they're going to get enough from when they're foraging in the pasture. And I look at that and I go, well, anybody else who is a skilled laborer is paid well for it. You call your plumber to come fix your pipes. I mean, just to get a drain clogged, I think my plumber was $125 an hour. It can seem like a lot of money to spend for these kinds of things, to support these people who are doing these different jobs. But ideally, if we were all doing what we loved and doing it well, we would all be earning a good wage from it. A lot of the conversations that I'm looking to have this year is about that idea of right livelihood. What is a real income? And I know, at least in my own life, a lot of that is also, well, what are my real needs versus, well, what do I just spend money on because I spend money on it and that kind of stuff, to figure out how much do I actually have to earn? But then when I'm making that, how can I make a difference with any excess? And for my wife and I, because we're financially able to, it is when I come and buy food from you or my other farmers, it's because I'm investing in the work that you do is part of what I get out of that. That it's money well spent, because that means then that this food that I like and enjoy is still going to be there. I want you to be here in 4 more years so that I can be in a place where I can come buy a whole pig, a whole goat, and, you know, an entire flock of chickens to put in my freezer. And I think that we need to have these discussions to to break down that myth of farming as unskilled labor. Because even the people who are picking our food have to know a lot of things to make that happen, let alone as a farmer who's running your business. And as you've already detailed, all these pieces you have to put in place to make it work.
The part about investing your money and coming out here and buying is the most intelligent thing you've said in the time I've known you, just by the way.
Considering the things that you've heard come out of my mouth, I don't know if I should feel.
Well, I think it's a good idea. I like it. Thank you.
Part of that, though, is recognizing money as a tool, not as an end or a goal, that money is something that I work with and do something with, that it's not about having $1 million in the bank because I don't know what I would do with it. That's part of the message of what I'm working with, is to understand how we can use these different pieces in our society to make a difference, to actually build a better world. And so that we can, but by me investing in you and me helping your family, you spend money with somebody else who lifts somebody else up, that I really like that idea that we lift each other up by all progressing and moving forward and the difference that that makes. All right, now that I've rambled a little about what it means to talk about this story of farming and the perspective that we're often given of what it's like, I mentioned Seth Wilner there at the beginning before I went down that path about farming as skilled labor, really to discuss what it's like from the farm planning stage, the financial side of things, because Seth had talked about, you know, doing a whole-scale integrated farm. He had talked about the cost of production that you may only be able to sell at a price that is actually below what your cost of production is, depending on your market, who you're selling to, what the local market can bear. I'd also done an interview with my good friend Erin Harvey about what it was like for her to be a small-scale vegetable farmer, and she still has a day job. You have a second business in addition to farming that you're running. It's not working for a corporation as you were doing before, but it is still a secondary business that provides additional income. How does all that work together for you to be farming, to have your farm, to have your family, and do the things that you want to do? As an example for my listeners of what this is like now that you're doing more of that.
So a month ago, I formed a company that I call Herring Coach. So www.herringcoach.com, wayne.herring@herringcoach.com. I formed a business coaching, sales training firm. This is the kind of work that I was doing before in the corporate world. In the corporate world, I was leading and managing a sales force who was in a growing business. We were expanding across the country, and I liked that work. And my employer compensated me well for the work that I did there. And in return for just and fair compensation, it was perfectly reasonable for them to expect that in the terms of my employment agreement, I was going to give them my undivided work time attention, right? So it was very appropriate that I would hop planes and grow and develop the sales force and grow our business and expand and do those things that they wanted to do. What that left me, though, was with a dilemma of sorts, in that when I was traveling and doing that business, which helped us buy this farm, helped us buy this really piece of ground that hadn't been farmed for quite a long time, where we've now built a home, a house, where we now have certain facilities to do sustainable farming. That other job provided all those things. But the farm had gotten to the point where I was having a difficult time giving that employer everything that they deserved. And it was a thing that caused internal conflict for me, because I believe that if I'm employed, I should fulfill my obligations, and not only fulfill them, but exceed those obligations and expectations. So I had a dilemma with that. And then the other thing that was happening was I was out of town. I was 4 states away, and my wife was left with homeschooling, taking care of 4 children, but also dealing with moving 6 10-foot by 12-foot chicken pens every morning. And that wasn't fair. And that wasn't meeting my whole life obligations, if you will, my family obligations. And it was causing a lot of stress on Catherine. And so what I've done now is I left that job after, you know, giving appropriate notice and doing all those things and working on transition. And I now have my own business where I'm doing the same kind of work. But now what I have is the freedom to choose, but maybe they choose me, but I have some freedom to make sure that I have a workload or a number of clients at certain times of the year that will allow me to exceed their expectations and deliver the service that I promised to them, but also allow me to plan my schedule, be here, go to get feed from my feed supplier, be here when the baby chicks are arriving, be within a reasonable drive if my wife says the pigs have all gotten out and they're in the neighbor's corn. So this new employment situation, if you will, is I'm going to have to design it with the help of others, with the help of advisors. We need to design this so that I do a great job for my clients and give them everything they're paying for and deserve and more so that I get more clients and that they keep me around, but also allow me to exceed the expectations of my food customers and my most important people who I need to take care of, which is, of course, my four children and my wife.
Having that kind of a balance is very important with your life, your family, your friends. Well, as you said, you're not on the road all the time anymore. You're not four states away. As just happened, we went, got some coffee, walked downstairs while I was sitting there talking with your wife. You went out and got some wood. You have a farm meeting tonight that you're going to be going through. What's it like both from a lifestyle change of living as a farmer as well as this business side?
We just have started this transition. We just started this new reality of me no longer working as a VP of sales for a company that's in a 22-state footprint. So this, our farming at the present time is slower in the winter. I think all farming is slower in the winter. But because we don't have a lot going on, I'm not sure exactly. I can't answer that yet entirely. What's it going to be like to be employed from the home and have a home-based business and also do farming? Because it just hasn't happened yet. It remains to be seen. But yeah, well, we took a little break there. Like you said, we went downstairs and I did. I went out to the wood pile and got a few pieces of firewood and brought them in and put them on the fire. And I also picked up a binder that my children, who are homeschooling downstairs, had put together for my business coaching practice, because now I can employ them in some of this. And now we're back in my office over top of the garage where we run the administrative aspects of the farm, the web page for the farm, the Facebook page for the farm, and where I also, of course, then do my other business. So how those things are all going to work together remains to be seen. You'll probably have to come back sometime next summer, right, during the heat of the production season on the farm, and I'll be able to give you a little bit more of an idea on that. But I really, what I see happening is having to be very intentional about planning farm time, business time, family time. And I've actually gone back to an old-fashioned paper calendar so that I can try to keep those things in their appropriate spot. Now, I've also invested in a little correction tape device because I know that things are going to have to be whited out and changed.
From my perspective, I think that kind of planning is essential to running a business.
And that type of planning is essential to everybody, whether they're in the, quote, traditional work world, or whether they have a farm, or whether they have a home-based business, or they're homeschooling. The reality is, with all of the media sources that are coming at us, communication, Facebook, all the opportunities we have to be sort of ADD, it's probably more important than ever that we try to compartmentalize our time. And we want to have freedom. I want to have freedom. I don't want to be ruled by the calendar, as you said. So there's balance there. And isn't that the key word? We keep saying that, balance, balance, balance. So that's what it's about. And I don't know how to have balance except by having other people in my life who help hold me accountable. And the other way, of course, is to step back and intentionally look at that calendar and look at the proportions that I'm giving to farming giving to family, giving to my business clients, etc. So we're gonna work on that in the coming year, and I think it'll probably be progress, not perfection.
It sounds like a big part of that in stepping back and finding balance is figuring out where you need to be and what you need to do so that you're actually meeting the things of value in your life. When you mention media and ADD, there's a book that was written by one of the core researchers in ADHD, and it's Driven to Distractions, I believe is the name of it. If it's wrong, I'll fix it in the show notes. But his thing is about all these inputs that we have, all these places where we can spend time and do things that easily take us away from the things that we want to do. Are you finding that that's part of your experience, is that you need to step back and make sure that only the right things are getting done?
Oh, sure. Without a doubt. Again, I don't think I'm, you know, necessarily good at that. But with the farm, and in a farm where we're doing our own direct marketing, there are so many things that we could be doing on the farm, whether it's making Facebook posts or contacting customers or actually building pens, etc. Yes, certainly it's important to make an inventory of the things that need to be done and determine which of those are critical paths. I need to be intentional about that. When you're talking about compartmentalizing time, the thing that it just came to mind all of a sudden, driving to get feed, driving to get grain. I wish I didn't have to do this, but I may have said this in the first interview that we have. I drive to Ole, which is about an hour there, 50 minutes to an hour to get to the farm. I load up on grain and then I drive it back here. And that's where I need to go right now to be able to have a source of organically grown grain. We're not certified, but it's organically grown grain, and that's where I need to go. Well, that feed run takes about 3 hours, and then another 30 minutes or so to unload the feed when I get back here. But that is so critical to what we do here, because we are feeding animals as we're pasture grazing them. Most of our, you know, the animals we have are omnivores. They need more than just what the ground and grass and bugs, so on and so forth, will give them. And that's one of those critical activities that just has to be done. We have to go and do that. And so last year, when I was working out of town, I couldn't do that when I was in Indiana or New Jersey. Now it'll be a little bit easier to get that on the calendar and make it happen. But still, that's critical. That needs to be done. And I can't wait until the feed bins are running empty to go to the feed supplier, because if one thing comes up, you know, it sounds funny, a thunderstorm and there's a tree down on the road to the farm where I buy the grain, yeah, I'd be bailing out and having to go to Agway, you know, and we're the local provider of commodity grain to buy feed for the animals. And I don't want to do that. My customers don't want to do it. I'd end up having to tell them what had happened. So that's one of those critical path activities. The other thing you deal with the kind of work we're doing here is, as a small farm, chickens, broiler chickens, grow 7 to 8 weeks. That's the time frame. And when it is the time to butcher those chickens, that's priority. Everything hinges on bringing the birds out of the field, processing them. Chickens, there's not a lot of forgiveness. You could take a pig and you could let it grow 3 or 4 weeks longer. And when you take it to the butcher, it's not going to be the end of the world. 3 or 4 weeks, maybe it gained another 30, 40 pounds of gross weight, but that's okay because you're selling it by the pound. It's okay. With a chicken, 1 week too early and they're too light, a couple weeks too long, and well, actually, some of the chickens that we buy today, they might even start dying of heat stroke. So there's no flexibility in that schedule either.
And as a farmer, you're a steward for these animals. You care for them. You can't let them run out of food. You can't not tend to them. You know, we could discuss ethically and morally if we wanted to, but I mean, just as a farmer, that is your product if something happens to it.
Right, right. As a farmer and having a farm business and needing to not, as much as we do these things for higher reasons, so to speak, there's a financial reality of we can't let the farm deplete our resources, financial resources. Boy, it's a strange thing as a farmer. The first time that I went to go out to the field and put chickens in a crate and bring them in for harvest, it really struck me as I was ready to catch the first one. When you're a farmer, you spend all of your time and energy taking care of the animals, being a caretaker. And I guess this has nothing to do with where we're going, but it just makes me think of this. You spend all your time and energy taking care of the animals, and you really, it's not just financial. You don't want anything to happen to them. You like them. They're not something, at least to me, and a lot of other people I talk to, they're not just widgets or glicks. They're living, breathing things, and you're taking care of them. You're caring for them. You care about them. And then all of a sudden, one day you go out in the field and you're no longer the protector and the caretaker, but you're the killer. And it's time to complete the cycle, so to speak. And it's a weird kind of psychological shift I've found when you do that.
I can think about that just from the first time that I went hunting and the first time that I took life in a meaningful way, if you will. You know, this isn't a mosquito that bites me or a fly on the wall or something. I've gone out deliberately to find something to kill it for food. This first intentional act of taking life and what that was like for me. And you just kind of standing there for a few minutes taking that all in. And I can only imagine, though, that you have to make that shift every time that you go then to harvest your stock.
It becomes a little bit easier, maybe. However, you know, the nice thing is we still only process chickens right now every other week or so. And it's still, you still pause. And the first time you load out, we don't harvest pigs here, hogs here. We take them to a local small family butcher who's USDA inspected. And the first time of the year that you load hogs on the trailer, it's just kind of tough. And then it's mixed emotion because you're also going to get paid and get some of your investment back, you know, that you've been fronting. Because pigs, you know, we could do a whole show sometime. You're talking the financials, but getting into some of these things, it's why I would recommend you start small the first time, because some of your bigger animals, it's really intense in terms of negative cash flow from the time you get the animal until you're able to market the hog.
Well, you talk there about being, you know, the protector and the shepherd, and then, well, if you will, the harvester. We've talked about financials. You are the person who picks up and delivers your grain. What roles running a small farm do you have to fulfill? Like, what are all the hats that you wear as a small-scale farmer who's doing a lot of the work yourself? What all do you do?
I do supply management, not always well, right? But I schedule the purchase and pickup of materials and the animals that are coming in that we're working with. We do bookkeeping. We keep financials. We want to know our profit and loss on individual enterprises within the farm. I want to know, are we making money on broiler chickens? Are we making money on pigs? Because I sure wouldn't want to not be making money at 30 hogs a year and decide that it's a good idea to do 60 with the same system, with the same price, with the same marketing, so on and so forth. If I'm losing money at 30, I sure wouldn't want to multiply that by 2 and go to 60. So we do bookkeeping, we do cost analysis. As a small farmer, I do my own marketing. You know, thankfully, we have customers who really do our marketing via word of mouth, via their posts on Facebook, so on and so forth. So we have materials, marketing, accounting and bookkeeping, taking care of the animals, which is huge. If something is going wrong and the animals seem to be sick, we have to try to figure out what to do about that. What's the next course of action? So minor veterinary things. That's what comes to mind quickly. Public relations, marketing, accounting.
Managing your website.
Supply, managing. Oh, yeah. So we did a website on our own with the help of the people at Small Farm Central, who have a nice tool for small farms. But we certainly manage our content. We manage our online store, manage our ordering, so on and so forth. There's some government regulations that we need to deal with. And so we communicate with those folks and work within their inspections and things of that nature. Work with a couple of restaurants to do some co-branded marketing with them. Lots of things. I like that because I like wearing a lot of different hats.
And it certainly keeps you busy.
Yeah, a little bit.
Another side of that that you mentioned was meeting regulation. And we said with when we weren't recording about, you know, all the costs that go into running a business between insurance and liability and all these other things. What are some of the things that people should be aware of as a small-scale farmer, or if they would like to start doing this kind of work, the regulations and the insurance and the other like business-related costs that go into running this kind of a farm?
Sure. Well, there's energy costs. So your electric bill will go up when you start running freezers and when you start to run brooder lights for chickens. So you need to think of that cost. Water, we're on a well, but it takes energy to pump the water out of the well, heat it, so on and so forth for processing. So there's that. Product liability insurance is something that we have. We have $1 million product liability insurance policy. Do you need those things? Maybe, maybe not. But in today's world, you're laughing, Scott. In today's world, it would be, I think, foolish to not have the necessary insurance to help protect. Heaven forbid, we do the best we can to produce good food, but you just never know. So we have that. Regulatory, there are certain small farm exemptions, but we do still need to produce food that is not misbranded. They call it misbranded, mislabeled food that's, you know, certainly we wouldn't want to produce. I think the technical term is adulterated food, but it needs to be fit for human consumption. It's really a matter of common sense things, I believe, and record keeping. We might want to just farm and just produce animals, but we really ought to have a written record of animals coming in, food going out, people that we sold it to. And those things aren't my favorite things to do, but we need to keep track of that. You may want to invest in some accounting services to make sure that, you know, you're filling out your taxes in the right way, and that we formed an LLC, we formed a business, so there's some small costs associated with that. I'm sure there's others, but those are the things that just come to mind quickly.
And I was just laughing a few minutes ago because of just understanding how expensive it can be to run something that you care about and to be, you know, above board and legal with it. And that as much as I would love to be in a world where I can just shake someone's hand and go, okay, we're cool, let's move on, and have a handshake and a smile and a verbal agreement, with the way that the world can be sometimes, all it takes is one person gets sick, one person gets injured, one thing goes wrong, and all these things that you've invested in can go away. Even if it's found in your favor, just the legal costs of getting there could be enough to ruin you.
Right, whether it's financial or whether it's emotional, yeah. The cost. We could do probably a whole talk, and lots of other people do. Should we all just be shaking hands and buying food and you know, doing it if there's two consenting adults and I decide to sell you some meat, should we just go ahead and do that sort of privately? But the reality of my world is, and probably a lot of other people in my position, is the internet is such a blessing, but it's also something that's challenging. And I have to do everything above board, as you say, because we use Facebook as our primary advertising medium, along with our webpage. And so we're really out there in the public eye. I may not have literally hung out a big sign at the end of my lane, and hardly anybody goes down my road, so they wouldn't see it anyway. But I've certainly, in the sense of the World Wide Web, I've hung out a huge shingle and said, here I am, here's how we're different, here's how we're unique, and we'd like you to come out and see what we're doing and buy some food from us. So those things are critically important and not even a question.
Well, just this conversation by agreeing to talk to me hits 10,000 people all over the world. Once it's out there, it's not like it can go away. Once it's been downloaded, we have no control over that. And yeah, I think I've gone all the places that I wanted to just to discuss what your life as a farmer is like from that period of looking to transition to actually being in transition, the different roles that you fill, the way that you're making this work. Is there anything else that you want to add to this conversation at this time? Because I'm sure we'll do another one in the future.
I think I want to say, Scott, to summarize from my point of view, is when you and I spoke back 6-7 months ago, I felt like our conversation was more structured, more linear. We talked about the path that we took to get to the point where we were at that time, how we started the farm, why we started the farm, what we were doing. There's no doubt that today, I hope I didn't frustrate you, but the conversation probably went sort of all over the place. It went up, down, left, and right, and into the weeds, and back onto a path. And that's really because that's, in a lot of ways, how our life is right at this moment. We're in this transition point. We are trying to figure out who we are as a family. How do we make a difference in the world in many ways, but also really keep our family together, raise our children in the best way possible, teach them responsibility, teach them the things that can come from the farm, lessen our impact, all those things. We are in the midst of that transition. And I imagine that if we talk again next summer, I still may get off track and may go left, right, up and down, but hopefully not quite as much as I did today.
The lack of structure and hearing your story is part of what is important to me in doing this show. We could sit with a list of 20 questions and hit point after point after point, but I don't find that that always answers the questions that people have to know what it's like behind the scenes. Your reflection on this is representative of where your life is at right now, I think provides a very inspirational note for us to end this on. So I thank you very much, Wayne, for sitting through all this with me, allowing me to rant and ramble and rave about some of these ideas as I still work through them in trying to share this message and ideas with others. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that was Wayne Herring. What I like about this conversation, in addition to the honesty that comes from it, was how this becomes an example of doing what you know. During my recent in-person workshop, one of the things that I was thinking about during that process, which came out in a question that someone asked me, was about how you make a living doing this kind of work. And the more that my focus on permaculture is towards the ethics as the core ideal from which to teach, and I look more to engaging social and economic systems with permaculture, I'm reminded of something one of my teachers told me, and it's, if you know something, use that. I found my niche in all of this by using my experiences with information technology and computers and this other equipment. And as Ben Weiss and I have talked about several times, and I think we may have to record a conversation about, you can apply the ethics of permaculture to any situation because they're the context in which we figure out the principles that are appropriate to any given human system or discipline. I truly think that we could teach permaculture to a video game designer and that they could implement those ideas within their game and the way that they do their work. Or even a car salesman, any profession or system. Organizers, politicians, professors, janitors, garbage men, doctors, any profession, any system. So if we've spent a lot of time becoming good at something, becoming an expert in our field already, why turn away from that? You have a lot of energy embodied in what you know. Do something with it. If there was a reason why you were called to it at one point, but now you might not necessarily enjoy it anymore, what about it could you take and extract from the pieces that you don't like to find your joy again, to find bliss in the work that you are good at, and use that to make a difference, and in turn, to build a better world? Whatever road you're on, whatever thing it is that you know that you would like to make a difference with, I'm here to help. I want to see you succeed and to integrate permaculture into what you're doing so that together we can all make a difference. Feel free to contact me if you have any questions or you want to talk through something. You can send me an email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266. And as I mentioned in the introduction, to keep this generous cycle of giving and designing improved systems, more holistic systems, systems that take care of the earth and people, and allows us the space to take care of ourselves, depends on your support. If you are in a place where you are able, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support and sign up for a $5 a month membership or more if you're able, and we can keep all this going. To all of you out there, thank you for taking this time to join me by choosing to listen to this show. I'll talk to you again soon, and in the meantime, take responsibility for your own life and that of your descendants, and together we'll take care of the earth, and from that, each other.